is the county putting in on it, or do they need us?
Welcome, everybody, to the Joint Committee on Transportation. For the record, it's February 14th, 2018. See, tonight we're taking up a number of the amendments that have been suggested to the bill. I will note for the record that there is one relating to the intermodal transfer facility process, and we will be taking that up next Monday, not tonight. All right, so we're going to start off with
Mr.
Senator Hansel.
Mr. Co-Chair, if we could, before we start this process, I just have to say something about the process. And I realize I'm old and I'm not very smart at times, but this has been very confusing for me. I'm not sure where we're at or where we'll end up, so I'm just warning people. When we get to the end of this process and we have this enormous bill, that doesn't necessarily mean by the time we get there I'm going to support all that enormous bill, because to be honest with you, I'm not sure at times where we're at and where these changes are coming from. But I respect we're trying to get through the process, but I just want you to know, because I sit here and don't nod my head or nod my head does not mean I'm going to support the bill when we get to the end.
Okay.
I think you speak for a number of us.
Okay.
I appreciate that, and following up on our discussion at the last meeting, what we're hoping is we're not looking for a yes or no definitively. I think the co-chairs we're sort of assuming a bit of a consensus. If you really object to something, it would be helpful if you would let us know that, either by saying it during the meeting or commenting to one of the four co-chairs. So we're trying to get to that. We recognize that there are a number of ideas that have been suggested on top of the technical fix elements. Those ideas, as with any bill, it's open. They have relating clauses that fit, and we'll consider them. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's an intention to accept that. So
thank you. I appreciate
it's like anything
that.
Else, we'll go ahead. But it would be helpful if you have strong objections to a piece of it. Don't sit silent. So what we wouldn't want to do is unintentionally get to the end and have something that in the bill that people had major objections to.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'm sorry, right. Senator. You're up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Beyer and Co-Chair McHugh, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29, North Central and Northeastern Oregon. I come before you today in support and urge the passing of both the -8 amendment and the -12 amendment to HB 4060. First, I would like to talk about the -8 amendment. Last session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 375. The bill allowed the placement of posters in rest stop bathrooms to combat sex and human trafficking. Legislative Council supports this amendment as a technical fix by removing Section 2 of the passed bill. What this will accomplish is that section stated that the Department of Transportation, Parks and Recreation Department, will wait until appropriations have been made before they could adopt the rules to the program. The individual that had was housed in the Treasurer's Department, and that particular account can't receive money until rules are made. So it was kind of a conundrum there, bureaucratic. So, and speaking with ODOT and Parks, they stated this program, combating sex and human trafficking, was too important to wait, and they agreed to move forward with the writing and the adoptions of the rules. Furthermore, removing this section will allow the department to begin implementing the program sooner rather than later. And again, I would bring to your attention that Legislative Council supports it. That's where it came from. Secondly, the
Let me address that just a second. In case people are wondering how this fits, you will recall that a major piece of section of 2017 had to do with restrooms and transferring things. So it really, really does fit into that section.
Yeah. Thank you. Second, the -12 amendment, I drafted these at the request of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I understand that J.D. Tubby from Kayak Transit testified on Monday, excuse me, and explained the need for this language. I do not want to belabor this point, but the amendment will essentially ensure that a tribe can appoint members to a joint committee for administering STIF funds. It is a technical fix and will reduce inefficiencies and redundancies in rural administration for these transit funds. Again, these are both technical fixes for last year's legislation. Encourage you to adopt them into House Bill 4060. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions to Senator Hansen. Any concerns about his proposals?
No concerns.
Nope.
Doesn't seem like it, Senator. Thank you very much. We got you in and out quick.
Thanks for the weather, the right change of ice.
Okay, Patrick, what's next? What is this?
That's going to be the Dash 6 Amendment, Mr. Chair.
The Dash 6 Amendment. Okay, so let me call up J.L. Wilson. And okay, I'm not going to pronounce your last name because I'm going to not do it well.
Thank you, Co-Chair Sambyer and McCune. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Daimler Trucks North America in support of the Dash 6 amendments. After the bill filing deadline had passed, Daimler had indicated to me that it was time for them to take their pairing and platooning technology on over-the-road type tests. As you know, they have a MADRS test track where most of that work is done. Also have a test track in Texas, a bigger diameter track where most of that work is done to achieve the optimal speeds. And now it is time to engage in more over-the-road testing, which makes sense in Oregon because headquartered in Oregon, their engineering group is in Oregon, their test track is in Madras. And interestingly, the one impediment to them being able to test over the road is the following distance law. And so what the Dash 6 amendment does is it creates an exception to the following distance law for any driver operating in a connected automated braking system. In other words, a pairing system. And that will allow Daimler to be able to engage in over-the-road testing of their pairing and platooning technology. And I want to make very, very clear, this is not automated vehicles. This is not autonomous vehicles. All of these trucks have a driver. The benefits to the platooning technology are, of course, very significant increases in fuel efficiency, significant reductions in carbon emissions, but probably most importantly, driver safety, driver comfort. It is there to ease the stress off of truck driving. And so it offers enormous benefits, and we think it's enormously consequential that Daimler wants to do this testing here in Oregon and develop that technology here. The last thing I'll say is we have been in communication with ODOT on this. This language has both been vetted and approved by ODOT, and so those communications and connections have been made with the agency. Thank you.
So, Jill, the Daimler's doing this now, aren't they, on 84?
That is correct.
So this is just recognizing that you're doing it, but there's a section of the law that's maybe problematic.
Today, when we do the tests, we do have to get a permit.
Put your name on the record.
Thank you. My name is Suman Narayanan. I am the engineering manager at Daimler Trucks, responsible for driver assistance and safety. To your question, Co-Chair Senator Bayer, we currently have to get permission from ODOT, and we do have to put a specific banner on the trucks saying test in progress every time we go out on the road. That is correct.
Okay. Go ahead. Director Garrett, can I ask you to comment on this?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Matthew Garrett, Director of ODOT, as Mr. Wilson indicated, we have reviewed this language and we're comfortable with it, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say that we think we have a good partner in Daimler. They have come to the table. They've helped inform the platooning conversation that has played itself out on I-84. I think that we do the discipline in working together, so we ensure we do it in a safe manner. Both for the Daimler professionals as well as the traveling public, those folks using IEDs, we're comfortable with the language.
If I may, to the committee here, explain what platooning is, what the purpose is, and give a little bit of background, it I hope would help. As you know, driver assistance and safety uses radar and camera technology to make sure that the trucks maintain a safe following distance, and they also make sure that in case of any emergency, we are able to automatically engage emergency braking. That has been our safety foundation, and the market is familiar with it. We know that the market sees benefit in these systems based on the acceptance rate and the take rate of these systems growing exponentially over the last few years. So in addition to the fact that the technology is mature, the technology is well vetted, the customers and the market and the society is also seeing the benefit. Now that we have a robust safety foundation, which also makes sure that the driver comfort is considered paramount, we are able to build on that operational efficiency. In this case, we are able to make sure that the trucks can follow at a safe following distance, but closer than what normally adaptive cruise control would allow, thereby helping us in optimizing airflow, thereby helping fuel consumption, which in turn has a positive effect on greenhouse gas. So that basically is platooning as a general term. Daimler Trucks North America wants to start with two trucks at the moment. So we refer to it as pairing. So two trucks that are identically built have identical specifications. When equipped with the right technology, which is camera, radar, and also a new technology that enables vehicle-to-vehicle communication, we are able to determine what kind of following distance is appropriate for fuel economy benefit. And also, for whatever reason, if the lead truck, the truck in the front, happens to encounter a traffic scenario or whatever it may be, instantaneously that information is fed to the following truck so that the pair can be safely broken and the safe distance can be maintained. So that, in essence, is the technology itself. And where we are today is that we have done extensive track testing. As you can imagine, we have one test track in Madras, Oregon, that allows us the freedom to have these nascent technology be tested and perfected before we can put it on the road. We also go to Texas, where Continental has a test track in Uvalde, Texas, where we are able to get up to 60 to 80 miles per hour, allowing us to safely demonstrate this technology and work out any technological challenges that this poses. So that is track testing. Now, where we want to go to is this technology needs time in real world. Whatever we can do in a track is only whatever we find in a track testing. The moment we expose this technology to the real world in a contained and safe way, we learn a lot. And the moment we learn, we are able to address it, thereby making it ready for a customer, ready for the society. Thank you.
Senator Gerard.
Yeah, the question that I would have, are we talking just four-lane roads where people have the ability to pass in another lane, or are we talking both four-lane and two-lane roads?
Thank you, Senator Gerard. We are currently talking about on-highway situations only, which means that it would be at least two-lane. It could be even four-lane, but it needs to be on a highway situation. And something that is conducive for maintaining 55 miles per hour speed. It would not be in a range where the vehicle speed has to be lower than that.
The follow-up question on a two-lane road, if someone wants to pass, are they going to have to pass the whole, you know, the two trucks, or are they going to, so the trucks would break so that you could have a place in between, or?
So that is a good question, though. One of the good things about putting it in real world is to be able to evaluate those scenarios. In case someone wants to cut in and take an exit, what would we have to do is determine that a car wants to cut in, break the pair, give a safe distance for the person to merge in, and then take an exit if needed. And then we resume back to the platooning mode when we determine there is no traffic.
excuse me. Representative Lively, Representative McLean, Representative Smith.
Thank you. And I had the opportunity when I served on transportation last year before, we had this conversation, and I appreciate the work doing, and I certainly support further testing. I'm just going to raise again the issue I raised then. As our freeways become more congested than they are, and as a person that commutes every day on I-5, and recently I passed a line of 26 trucks in a row and made it very difficult. They weren't driving that close together. It made it very difficult for two people that were trying to get off an exit. I'm just concerned the long-term implications of very congested highways and or our freeways and not, and how this technology applies or doesn't apply, and what that does to the traveling public that isn't in one of those trucks. I support the test. I applaud the safety that's involved with this. All that makes sense to me. But I just want to keep an eye on the longer-term implications, especially on our freeways that are just getting more and more plugged, and what that does to the other travelers on that freeway.
Okay, thank you. Representative McClain.
Really and truly, that both of you have covered it. I had just had somebody talk to me down in one of the meetings that were in California on some of these issues, and I'm really glad that you have people in the vehicle and that it's not fully autonomous yet while you're doing this testing. But is there a situation where you have some studies that you've, like, in our state, you can only have two trucks, right? Like two trailers on a truck? Is that right?
Three. Madam Chair, there are certain routes that you can do triples.
Right. Okay. So there's in certain places.
Certain
right?
places. Yes.
Yeah. And so you're only using two trucks in this, not three with three trailers, but two trucks.
That is correct, Senator McLean. We are Representative McLean. We are talking about only two trucks equipped with 53-foot trailers. Those are our first area of focus.
Okay, because they had a lot of trouble. Same situation with getting people off the freeway.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Colleagues, if I missed the answer to this earlier, I apologize. Interstate 84 is a long stretch of highway. Could you be more clear in what part of Interstate 84 you're looking at?
Thanks, Representative Smith. We are talking about anywhere where we are able to achieve freeway speed. So 50 miles per hour is where we would see some benefits. So if you have a stretch where we are going to have the vehicle speed come down, then the aerodynamic benefit, thereby having fuel economy and greenhouse gas benefit, is going to dramatically drop. So this technology requires vehicle to be freely running at a certain speed. So the stretch, exactly what you're referring to, is dependent on what we're able to achieve in terms of vehicle speed.
So just, Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, I guess I would advocate for you to visit with the good folks in Umatilla, Moro, Yellum, Sherman, and Wasco counties as it relates to Interstate 84 that goes right through their front door. I'd be more than willing to help get that list.
Thank you.
Representative Bonham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it right now, we're in a voluntary relationship with ODOT, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and so since we don't have any specific rules, you're asking for this following rule as a matter of traffic law, not as a matter of a testing protocol or anything else that we're putting in place.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Well, sure. No.
Oh, sorry, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I mean, everybody else over here, I mean.
So, JL, are you just trying to restrict troopers from writing tickets? Is that what you're trying to do?
Pretty much.
They're moving everybody out of the cab so there's no one to write one against. No. Any others? Thank you very much. Colleagues, I will just note that this is one that's probably a little, it's certainly a transportation issue, but it's a little far from what 2017 is. Do people have any objection to taking care of that in this bill?
Mr. Chair, I don't have an objection, but because much of this will occur in House District 57, I need to do a little more research on it.
Okay.
And it is the first time I've heard about this issue.
Actually, it is occurring, Representative. It has been for about a year. But other than that,
it's the first time I've heard of it.
He hasn't had the economic benefit yet.
Okay. Anybody else want to talk about that?
Right.
Don't see anybody. All right. Who's up next? Dina Mack. Oh, there she is back there, Department of Revenue. Welcome back.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I'm here. I've been working with Patrick and LRO and some of the members here on some technical issues related to the transit tax. There's a couple issues in 320.550, which is the transit tax. One relates to what we call kind of a double taxation issue. The tax is calculated on wages, and then it's also calculated on periodic payments, which is typically retirement income. Lots of people have their retirement income contributions taken out of their pay, taxes calculated on that. But then 5 years down the road, when they actually withdraw it, the tax is calculated again. And so there's no remedy in the statute to deal with that double taxation component. So we're working with folks on that. Another item, there's an internal inconsistency with the definition that you chose for wages. Wages is defined in 316.162, which is the standard payroll tax statute that we use for income tax withholding, and employers are very, very used to. It automatically includes certain exemptions like Amtrak Act, like common carriers. It excludes certain items such as some military pay out of state, some things like that. But then later in the bill, it talks about the calculation is based upon wages without exemption or deduction. So it's an internal inconsistency because the definition you chose actually automatically includes some exemptions or deductions. So that phrase, we think, probably was a drafting error. It really can't be both. So, and then the last thing is that the department is wanting to have some rule writing authority for outlier situations where there are taxpayers who are residents of the state who earn income outside of the state and how they calculate it, because their employer, if that employer has no nexus with Oregon, they're not going to be withholding for them. So we need some rule writing authority to tell them how to calculate that amount, because they have to do it annually on their personal income tax return. And so that's the technical issues that we're asking for, and we're working with the folks in LRO and LC to accomplish those for you.
So I can tell you for sure that when we were doing that provision, we had no intent to include pension income.
We were only talking about wages.
So that your request seems entirely appropriate to me, and it's a technical fix that we hadn't picked up before. Does anybody have an objection to that?
Don't they need to stop continuing to unwork and get it done quick, because we're running up against deadline.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
they won't get it.
Yeah, Senator Boquist, they have not, we haven't actually started calculating the tax yet, because it becomes effective July 1. So we can get these instructions out to employers on how to do this, and also taxpayers, before the change becomes
effective. So you'll work with staff and Legislative Council, get the language right. Okay.
Happy to do so.
Quickly.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Quickly, yes. We don't have a lot of time.
So next up is.
So who am I up to? These two? Chris Zuckin and Dan Dura. Did I get it right?
And if you want, maybe we could have Amy come up also. And maybe a panel of three. Amy Joyce is here to speak on this also. Maybe come up and have it. All three of them.
Amy, you want to join on this one?
Mr. Chair,
divide and conquer, Amy.
I'd like to ask Ms. Joyce whether or not she's working for the food bank tonight.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I take it that wasn't serious. Please.
She's a good worker to garner money for the food bank.
Ah, good.
Co-Chair Beyer, Chair McCune, and committee members, my name is Chris Zuckin. I'm the general manager of Meadow Outdoor Advertising in the Dalles, Oregon. We are a family business, and this year we will have been in the billboard business for 50 years. First of all, I'd like to say that we have a great working relationship with ODOT. We probably talk or email with someone on staff weekly. Over the last 10 years, we've had multiple meetings with various members of ODOT on this subject. And in fact, 20 minutes ago, we met with ODOT attorney Amy Joyce and the subject. And I think it's safe to say that at this point, I think we have more common ground on this proposed legislation than not. One of the topics that we did talk about was the state of Idaho. Our closest neighbors, Idaho, California, and Washington, all have just compensation laws on the books. All three promote relocation over condemnation, as does our proposed legislation. But if relocation is not possible.
I need you to state your name for the record, please.
Oh, no, he didn't. If I may clarify, just so we're clear on what we're talking about, this would be House Bill 4060, sections 35 to 38.
I apologize.
Oh, it's okay. I should have mentioned that before. So it's
Now I'm confused. There's a separate House bill that speaks to the same.
Oh, no, these are sections in House Bill 4060.
Oh, I'm.
Yes, there's a separate bill, Madam Senator.
House bills.
It's right
we're
here.
Not used to it.
Thank you. It's too much DayQuil today. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
At any rate, our three neighbors have similar laws, and we're patterning this compensation over at least parts of that. Lastly, I would refer to the just compensation matrix that I think is listed under Tom Barrow's name in your material, which speaks more to where the state of Oregon is in relation to the other states in the country. Thank you for your consideration.
Anything to add?
Co-chairs Meyer and McEwen and members of the committee, my name is Dan Druva. I'm the general manager for Pacific Outdoor Advertising, which is a billboard company based in. We employ 26 people there. I've spent the last 12 years of my career in this industry, and just to echo a lot of the sentiments that my colleague, Mr. Zukin, just said, I support this bill, 4060, with these sections 35 through 38. Currently, when ODOT is undergoing a public project, sign companies are brought into the loop, unfortunately, very late in the game. And this bill would assist ODOT in acquiring property during these public projects to work with the sign owners and find suitable areas to relocate them. And if none can be found, to justly compensate the sign companies for their loss of their signs. But I just want to add that it's always our foremost intent to retain the signs whenever possible. It's our business. We prefer to continue to provide that service for our clients and our advertisers rather than take a check from ODOT any day. So I urge your support in HB 4060, these sessions.
And I assume, gentlemen, from prior discussions we've had over the past few years is that where the outdoor advertising is different than other industries is because of the federal law, if you lose a sign, you've lost the business, in essence. You can't, it's very hard to relocate a sign other than in the immediate area of that. So I think your compensation, as you've had told me before, is more to encourage ODOT engineers as they were designing something to try really, really hard to keep it in the current location. Or somewhere in that.
We definitely prefer to keep or relocate as opposed to lose and compensate. Yes.
You have a question?
I do. Senator? I have two questions. One of them is, if you're closer in common ground now in negotiations, why do we need to deal with this in this bill? I mean, it sounds to me as though you're very successfully negotiating. You're trying to work out a protocol. And I'm just curious why this needs to be embedded in the bill.
Senator Johnson, The area of common ground that we are close on is this new language in the statute that we're proposing.
Okay, my next question is, you used the word justly compensate.
Yes.
And that's been a problem that I've had with this right straight along. If the sign moves 12 feet and the sight line is off by just a little bit, who makes the decision about what just compensation is? It seems to me to be open-ended and an invitation for litigation.
Senator Johnson, if the sign is able to be relocated, there would be no just compensation. The only time compensation would come into play would be if the sign is not relocated. It cannot be relocated. It must simply be removed.
Okay, then one more. Okay. Who makes that determination of just compensation?
The bill would base just compensation on market value. And we were just having this conversation 20 minutes ago. There are several appraisers in the country who specialize in billboard valuation. They value billboards for both billboard companies, states, cities, counties, and they would make the evaluation determination based on market value.
Okay, that invites one more question. Give me a sense of scale of how much we're talking about, and I'm now demonstrating how little I know about your industry. But what's the average worth of a sign? When one drives into Salem coming south, there's a veritable forest of signs. What are those worth?
Senator Johnson, the range is wide. We, in the last 10 years, we lost one small sign structure in Woodburn. The value of that sign was $1,500. There are billboards on I-5 that are probably worth $250,000. So it's based on size, revenue, traffic count, length of lease, a whole number of factors.
One last question, Mr. Chair. Who bears the burden for bringing in the appraiser from Kathmandu or wherever they're flying in from?
You know, Sarah Justin, that has not yet been determined, but that's something I'm confident we can figure out. That could be the obligation of the sign company. I don't. That's not a problem. We would certainly accept that responsibility.
Thank you.
Representative Bonham.
Why doesn't this work like any other condemnation process where you've got an offer being made? If you accept it, fine. If not, then you've got a process that may include litigation if you can't resolve it otherwise. Is this different?
It has been handled, Representative Vail, it has been handled different in the past by ODOT. ODOT has treated billboard structures as personal property. As simply said, just move them off the property like you would a welding machine or a car. Our position is that they aren't that easily moved, and each location is unique and valuable. So that's why we are here to and rectify that.
Follow up, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. So essentially, you are trying then to conform it to typical condemnation type of practice. Real property condemnation.
Absolutely, property. Yes. And okay. And consistent nationwide with billboard valuation and condemnation practices.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I think I've followed most of what's here, and I appreciate that. So the question I have, there's also, and it talks about the sign being in compliance with provisions of ORS. So I'm trying to understand, are the signs, what these provisions are that either the sign's compliance or not, and how many signs out there that may be involved in the discussion about Moon are not in compliance anyway?
Representative Lively, that basically means that any sign that would be capable of being reimbursed for condemnation would be legal, non-conforming, or legal conforming signs. They would comply with the existing statute.
Existing statute.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Other questions?
Chair Byer and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and I will echo much of what my fellows at the witness table have said. I've been working with Mr. Zukin for 15 years from back when I started ODOT running the sign regulation program, and Mr. Durva for the 12 years he's been doing this, and we do work well together. Fundamentally, in terms of what's in 4060, the agency understands that it's a policy choice for the legislature whether to shift to paying compensation dollars when a highway project hits a billboard and there can't be a relocation. And so our role is to inform and help craft the legislation that would go in that direction. So we've been in discussions with Mr. Barrows and with these two gentlemen about ways to amend to draft an amendment to get to that solution. And there's sort of a construct we've already been discussing. One is the sort of Idaho model where it gets stated that the policy of the state is that we move heaven and earth to try to find a suitable spot for these signs, and that's the policy of the state, and not to pay just compensation unless we absolutely have to. And then if we reach a point where a suitable relocation can't be found, then it's the question of how much compensation. There are a couple of different ways those values can happen across the country. And in discussions with these two gentlemen, you know, there are comps, there are, you know, the profit from a sign over a certain number of years. There are different ways to do this. So we need to discuss that. And then there's a process question as well. So in the bill as written, the sign would stay up until ODOT cut them a check. In the world of condemnation, that's just not a practical solution, and these gentlemen indicated that was not their intent in the drafting, but that would need to be fixed. But in terms of process, you know, you could go a full-blown condemnation where you go to circuit court and hire lawyers and go to trial, or we could come up with something a little more efficient and inexpensive like an arbitration or a contested case hearing. I think we need to discuss that as well. Two elements in the bill that are quite problematic. The one that I mentioned, where the sign stays up until ODOT cuts a check, that's just not practical. And the other one in Section 35, that our reading of it is that ODOT needs to design a project to avoid billboards, period. And what that does is essentially elevate billboards over any other thing that we might hit
in a taking. Again, the billboard folks have indicated that was not their intent. I think I understand what their intent is. So we have quite a bit of work to do in short order to come to an amendment that is going to work under this sort of list of things that need to get done, but we're committed to working with the industry and with Mr. Barrows to get there.
Senator Johnson.
I'm very concerned about the notion that a project would have to be redesigned to avoid a billboard. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the ultimate tail wagging the dog. You could run the price of a project through the ceiling and have some odd traffic alignment that might not be safe. Until there's some clarification on that, I am not very comfortable with this.
Senator Vile, and then, excuse me, Representative Vile, and then Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've got a condemnation process in the state that includes immediate possession issues, that includes the valuation under ORS 308. Is there any reason why we shouldn't just be tracking the typical real property condemnation statute? Is there anything else that makes this unique, I guess, is the question I'm asking? Because I'm having difficulty thinking of
it. Chair Beyer and Representative Vile, the OMIA, the sign regulation world, is a unique animal. My position, too, is that billboards are unique. Billboards have value only for one reason, and that is because of the public investment in the highway, which puts eyes in front of billboards. I think it is a less efficient process than I think what can be developed in this unique statutory structure. In Oregon, because of our very limited capped permitting system on billboards along state highways, there are something like 1,500 perhaps now permitted billboards in the whole state. They're all relatively similar. I think there's a much more efficient way to go about it.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. Is there a market for billboards? Are they traded like any other real property? So if they're traded like any other real property, then that market, it seems to me, would have taken into consideration the unique characteristics of a billboard, right? And so if you look at ORS 308-2 that defines what real market value is, and it takes into account the amount a typical seller would accept or the amount a typical buyer would offer, haven't we kind of captured the unique aspects of a billboard?
Chair Beyer, Co-Chair McEwen, and Representative Vile, I think the devil is in the details. We're committed to sitting down and hashing through this and figuring out a way forward. I don't know that the condemnation process is the most efficient way to handle these things. Again, both the agency and the industry are in unison saying that the deal here is that we never hit a billboard. So this is going to be done rarely, and I think we can come up with a more efficient way and a more efficient.
Just a follow-up comment, Mr. Chairman, then I would just hate to see us reinvent a whole new process for a relatively small group of folks where we've already got one in place, and it, as far as I know, it works pretty good.
The only comment I would have on that would be it's different if you look at it as a structure, simple structure, and look at it as the structure and replacement value, versus if you would look at it, which I think you are, and say this is a business. If you were selling this as a business, what is the value of that? That's kind of the nature. Each of these signs are like a separate business.
But in typical condemnation law, we take into consideration both in any condemnation environment. The effect on a business of a structure.
I would think it's different, but I hear what you're saying. Representative Lively, then Representative McEwen.
Mr. Co-Chair, I have a couple, just two simple questions. Before these proposed changes, does ODOT currently pay compensation for moving billboards, or is there involved in the project?
Co-Chairs Beyer and McEwen and Representative Lively, under today's system, ODOT pays to move the billboard,
okay.
So pay to take it down, move it, reinstall it, pay for the permitting, sometimes upgrade it. That's the system today. That's what the bill seeks to change.
To change.
Is to move to a payment when a new location, new suitable location, suitable to the industry doesn't work.
And so one more follow-up. So under the, whichever system, so those are costs that are allowable in the for state transportation funds. So that's what pays for these this moving. So highway funds.
Co-chairs Beyer and McEwen, Representative Lively, yes, with federal contribution.
Okay.
Can I a clarifying question on that? If you're just, if the billboard can't be moved, you just pay the cost of taking it down?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so get back to Representative Vial. So they don't get, it's not paid for as a business.
Well, that's what I'm saying, and that seems inherently unfair to me. Because in a normal situation, if you're taking somebody's garage, they can relocate a garage somewhere and they still have their business. It may not be as good a location, and we'd compensate for that. But if they can't, if there's nowhere to relocate to, if there's no highway to be next to, you really have suffered a loss.
I think that's why they're there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. I think I want to step back just a moment. I think this is an example of some concerns that I raised today as I was going through the process of preparing for this meeting. And I think you were, this was the first issue that came up that was, I think, attached to the package that had a little bit of a distance from the intent of 2017. And that kind of made some sense to me. this has been, it sounds like, in the works for a very, very long time. It's a negotiation that didn't start with the transportation package. I think there may be some desire to end it with the transportation package, but is this the appropriate place to do it? Now I'm not quite sure. But here you are. We are going to hear a number of amendments over the next two or three meetings now that are getting even a little bit farther afield from the implementation of 2017. And as I was reading through some today, I'm getting more and more concerned that the integrity of what we are trying to do may be being eroded a little bit. And I just wanted to note that, Chair Beyer and members of the committee, that as we go through these amendments, we consider what our true mission is here with the transportation package. Yeah. And just kind of look to it with an eye towards that. Not that this isn't an important issue. I think it is. And I think, again, when we first started, it made sense to have that conversation here. But I just want to note that we are, we seem to be gaining momentum.
Yes,
I'll just note that. Senator, I'm sorry, I'm not in charge.
Bills have a chance to do that, don't they? Senator, Representative McLean.
Well, you guys are all, okay, at this point, after all of the comments that have been made, I think the one thing that I don't know if it belongs in this bill or not either. But as far as I'm concerned, I really don't want to give lawyers more work. I don't want to go through processes where we have to go to, you know, you've got plenty of work to do down here. But it's one of those things where I think we whatever we do, whether it's in this bill or not, I do like your approach. You're sitting down talking about it, and I'm going to assume that it's better than having us in court with a bunch of bills. And so, and you don't want bills either. And so the situation is, whether it belongs here or not, let's keep talking. And, you know, if you think it might be in the bill and that makes you talk faster and better, then that's good too. But I think we want to make sure it's fair and that we're doing the right thing with the highway fund.
Okay. Senator.
This may be an analogy with too big a stretch, so bear with me for a second. I'm reading the language, and the starkness of it just struck me. Design work on highways to protect outdoor advertising signs from being blocked, damaged, destroyed, or lost during construction. And it causes me to remember with some PTSD a time in my life when I was trying to negotiate ingress and egress with ODOT. And there were instances where a highway segment would take away access, and I'm thinking specifically of an ingress and egress to a bank, where their road to their drive-through teller window was going to be destroyed by a project. And it was kind of like, get over it. That's the way the project is designed. This seems to hold out outdoor signs to a special standard that says you have to design around it. And I'm trying to think, how is this equitable to the business that loses its ingress and egress, or ingress or egress, on a highway project? Should they not be, when it's existential to their business, deserving of the same level of protection, which suddenly has us designing highways with pretty bizarre criteria other than the safe throughput of passengers and freight? And I don't know whether I'm stretching this elastic to the point of breaking, but I remember conversations with people who were losing their access by virtue of a new highway construction, and I think that they ought to be considered in this conversation if we're going to consider elevating billboards to a special status.
You have one to respond?
Sarah Johnson, the intent of that language is to avoid the taking or the condemnation of the sign structure. And I'll give you an example. In the last 10 years, there have been four billboards in the state of Oregon that had to be removed due to a highway project, and all four of those could have been kept in their location had the right-of-way been changed by 2 feet. So these are not major changes. It's not making large changes to the highway. It's minor changes that would allow the sign to either be remain where it is or relocated back onto the same property.
Regrettably, we're held to the four corners of the page. And while I understand that we ought to be thinking about a process that accommodates a 2-foot move, we're left with the language that says design work on the highways to protect outdoor advertising signs from being blocked, damaged, destroyed, or lost during construction. I think that it unweights a negotiation disproportionately in favor of you guys. And while I'm sympathetic to what you're talking about, I don't know why you're so special as differentiated from a bank that's going to lose its ingress and egress to a highway by virtue of a project. I for me, it's a matter of equity.
So, if I may, Chair Beyer and Senator Johnson, and I will say that is also how we read the language of the bill. Is the way you're describing. That said, having discussed that with the industry, they have represented to me, and I trust these individuals and their representative, that was not their intent, that the intent is, you know, if we put up a sound wall along a highway that blocks a sign, that's an impact, and we need to take these things into consideration. And so I think that's where the detail work of coming up with an amendment gets down to. I agree that to us is quite challenging language, but I think it is not, as the four corners exist, that's not the intent of the industry. I trust that representation is true, and that we will work through what they're trying to get to, which is fundamentally we're trying to not take billboards, but they don't have a special status above homes, businesses, churches, cemeteries, wetlands.
This building has a very short memory, and I just think that what is written down and memorialized in statute needs to be a reflection of intent. It will become the law. And one day when we're all said, all gone, it's the four corners of the bill. And I can't support this the way that it is written. If you guys are continuing to grind away on language, go for it, have at it. But I can't support this.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. I guess I have a question, then I have a statement before I get ejected by both co-chairs. Would you go back? I believe we're not reinventing the wheel here, by the way. And I agree with the good second. Senator, almost to the far right, you know, I don't like the full employment of lawyers either. And, of course, the lawyers wrote this, and I'm not sure what they were thinking, but I agree with everything Senator Johnson. But that being said, we're not inventing this, because obviously there are appraisers who do this, and there's at least 4,900 states that have this same problem. And it sounds to me like they've solved this problem in a different way, and you're bringing that sort of solution here to Oregon and trying to implement that solution where. Is that really not what we're doing here?
Yes, sir.
Right. So it's not like we're creating something new. It's just we're creating something the Oregon way, which is in line with the other 49. And as long as we come to some conclusion or way to actually do it the Oregon way, somewhat in line with the rest of the nation, then we're in line with what the federal government will reimburse that everybody missed here that they pay part of this price too. Am I correct?
Co-chairs and Senator Boquist, I think that's largely true. The Oregon way being 49 other jurisdictions all do it a little bit differently, some more differently and less differently. Mm-hmm. And so getting the details that we have to come down to is which method do we rely on, or excuse me, land on, which process do we land on that works both for industry to maintain their businesses and for protecting the highway fund. And we can get there, but it's not as if all 49 states do it exactly the same way and we're the outlier. There are differences, they do matter, and that's what the detailing work will be in the coming days.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
Just to make clarity, too, one of the challenges is with the word of the law. We're going to see another issue on Monday that has that, and some of us interpret and remember things differently. But part of the word of the law that Senator Johnson to my left pointed out is Section 26, and so here's where I'll get ejected. I understand we have growing pains and this transportation issue is before us, but Section 26 is titled Joint Committee on Transportation, and the envisionment was that at some point the two co-chairs that are to my right here are eventually going to lose their chairmanships of the other one committees at some point as we transition, and we're going to have one consolidated joint transportation committee. So while I do appreciate we're still trying to fix HB 2017, I concur with Madam Co-Chair McEwen to the right. We're still trying to fix that. At some point, we are going to transition into this, and the notion was, and we wrote the law, colleagues, and we voted for it, all except, I think, one member here, was, in fact, that we're going to consolidate transportation committees. So these odd transportation issues are going to kind of come around eventually. And so this is just an unfortunate growing process we have because we haven't finished the original bill. So I just want to point out that as we sort of go forward, that was the intent we have, and if we're going to have to fix that, we might as well fix that too.
Just a quick question, Amy, and I'll get you to the Senator. It sounds like you are working towards a solution, compromise, whatever. Does it take a statutory change if you come to agreement?
Chair Beyer, I think that it does. For one thing, we've been doing it one way for a very long time to switch gears in the world of administrative, the executive branch. We can't just change the way we've been doing things. I think there are some things in the statute that need to talk about compensation. And so, yes, I do believe there is a statutory change necessary.
Senator Monroe.
Question for ODOT. Would you ever change a preferred design to avoid one of these signs?
Co-chairs and Senator Monroe, unfortunately, I don't work on the design side of ODOT. What I will say is my understanding, when the agency is looking at a project and, you know, what right-of-way are we acquiring, what is the best path, ODOT is looking at everything. We're, you know, what's around it? What are we going to hit? What are the wetlands? What's the best construction? So all things are taken into consideration. I guess that's my best response. I'd be happy to get a design professional and come in and talk with you, Senator. But we're looking at everything. We're looking at the whole picture when we're deciding the right of way to acquire.
But then you get a preferred design. This is where we want to build this. And oh, by the way, there's a sign in the way. Would you ever change it rather than mitigate that sign? We're talking a lot about how you mitigate a sign. You find a different location for it, or you pay money. Would you ever do that? That's I think what Senator Johnson's original question was all about.
They would have to if this language passed.
Co-chairs and Senator Monroe, under the existing set of laws, by the time we get to a preferred design, we have taken into consideration all of these aspects and made that considered decision, and then it's the preferred design. So if a billboard is in there and that was the best decision considering all of the factors, then we're not going to, it's already been considered. And if then the billboard gets hit, then the billboard gets hit.
Well, I'd like you to keep working and maybe tweak this language so that it makes it real clear that you don't change the preferred design because of a billboard.
So, others, what's your thinking right now in terms of, are you working on, is this something you would be able to work out soon, or is this something that you're looking to having to work collectively on and bring it back in, you know, half a year when we start the 19th session?
Chair Beyer, the agency's intent is to have something ready to go for this bill this session.
Is that generally worth considering?
Well, Senator, I don't have any problem considering. Given this conversation, though, I don't know what will get to the point we're totally comfortable
just
with.
Just looking at the calendar, if we were going to revisit this again, we could do it no later than next Wednesday. Is that right, Matt Patrick?
Yeah,
next Wednesday. The schedule right now is to have a final amendment available on the 26th.
Mr. Chair, we're going to schedule next Wednesday's meeting as a sleepover, if that's okay.
A sleepover? Buddy, bring your jammies. So that means you would have to work something out soon so LC could write something and have it posted. And okay?
Understood.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Well, Ms. Joyce is right there, Mr. Chair.
Don't leave.
I only bring this up because I was expecting to see Ginny Lang in the room to speak to the Pacific Wonderland plate, and I'm wondering if she's not here, but I'm wondering if anybody else in the room was here to speak in support of that concept. And if not, since she's not here, and since we have Amy right there, if maybe she could address ODOT's view on the Pacific Wonderland plate section.
Is that okay?
Wonderful idea, right?
Wonderful idea.
Co-Chair Beyer, Co-Chair McEwen, the agency is just fine with the proposed change to the Pacific Wonderland plate, which is to completely lift the cap on the number that are available to be issued. Right now it's at 80,000. We're going to hit that probably pretty soon before the 2019 session, and so this would be the time to lift the cap if you want to continue issuing those plates.
Mr. Chair. Senator. May I channel Ms. Lang for just a moment? Colleagues, the beneficiary of these plates are the Oregon Capital Foundation, Oregon State Capital Foundation, and our beloved historical society that is the repository of the tangible treasures of Oregon. Their popularity attests to the fact that we need to lift the cap, and I know that if Ms. Lang were here, she would plead with you to do so.
Here, here.
Good job.
Second that. Does anybody object to this wonderful idea?
Wouldn't dare.
Okay, that one's done.
Let's go to Rich next.
All right. You want to address which number is this?
Oh, this would be for the Dash 7 Amendment, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Angstrom.
Dash what? Seven.
Good evening, everybody. Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. Since it's Valentine's Day, I'm hoping we're going to share some love for rocks today. I've been preparing that all day.
Tiny rocks.
We'll laugh.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do accomplishing this bill is really a streamlining and getting the experts on subject matter aligned with the decision making. In its simplest form, what this bill does is if a farmer comes in next to a proposed mine site and raises a concern, that concern has to get addressed. The industry is completely supportive of that, always has been, being good neighbors. But the question is, who gets to resolve the issue? And what the bill does is it says if a state or local or federal agency that has subject matter over that particular conflict, it's in the what the bill says is relevant to that conflict, the agency or the local government defers to the expertise from that, from those folks. And to change it over to the other side, if it does not, if the conflict is raised and that agency, you know, the local, state, or federal agencies don't have rules that address that conflict, it stays with the local government. So it works both ways, what we're trying to accomplish here. I know that's a little bit complicated, but this, what this bill does, is only limited to transportation, mine sites that are going to be used for transportation projects, and those conflicts around agriculture. So with that, what we're trying to accomplish is to reduce the duplication. Right now, local governments and all the agencies get a resolved issue. So we have now a system where people are watching, are basically, we're trying to get an application through. We have decisions by multiple agencies and jurisdictions over the same topic. And it creates a little bit of a problem for us. We think this will line up coordination between local governments and other agencies. And most importantly, what it does is it gets the technical people. Think about it this way, is if you have a conflict with an agricultural issue over groundwater, it's a pretty technical issue. Water Resources or DOGAMI have hydrologists on board that resolve those issues. And they should be the ones that are resolving those issues. It shouldn't be a local elected official that is trying to hear from all sides and balance it. These are technical issues, and they should be resolved in a technical way. What the amendment does, what it doesn't do, it does not limit a farmer from raising any objection at all. They can raise all the objections and concerns, and they always have been able to do that. What it does do is it limits who gets to decide the issue, and that's what's important here, is who gets to decide these pretty thorny issues at times. So with that, I got to tell you, back up what brought us here, because that's a very heavy land use piece, for sure. But what brought us here is we have tried to resolve this issue out in other committees in the legislature over the years, and haven't had no success. And we've attacked it or approached it from how it's affecting our business folks, how it's affecting Wilder Sand and Gravel or Knife River or Old Castle Materials or Baker Rock Products. And we have not been able to resolve the issue addressing it from just our business perspective. But it's getting to the point with the aggregate supply issues and the increasing demand that you are moving forward with is as far as transportation packages with what's happening on the federal side, is that right now the demand for aggregate material is extremely high. Our guys are very busy. But the exhaustion rates of the mine sites, we can start foreseeing that it's happening. There needs to be a permitting cycle. And if the legislature at some point doesn't resolve that issue, we're going to have a cost problem associated with that, the restriction in demand and supply. We already know that if you, from data we have used from DOGAMI and ODOT, that if you move our industry 1 mile away from the market, on average, it costs the state $6 million in additional transportation costs. We actually think over time, in the next 10, 20 years, that it's going to be 10, 20 miles away from the market. So you can see the real dollars add up very quickly. And the numbers we use, by the way, are all studies that the industry didn't do. They were done by ODOT and they were done by DOGAMI. And we took the conservative approach. Our members think it's probably considerably higher than the impacts of the state. So when you realize that the cost of the materials are roughly half, not every situation is the same. In a bridge, you know, it's more labor, less materials. On a chip seal, it's almost all material. And on a normal asphalt job, it's kind of about half. But the data that we have, and it's a little, using a term that came up, which we thought was kind of funny, was data that's a little dusty, is about 50%, around 52% of the cost of a highway, typical highway project is related to the material, the purchasing the materials. Our number one cost is the transportation cost. It is moving that product. It isn't actually the production of the rocks. It's actually moving it to the job site. So the reason we're here in front of you on this issue is you can't have a pro-transportation policy in the state and not address the demand for aggregate. They're absolutely linked. And if you want an affordable and readily available supply material, you're going to have to address this coming looming issue that's before us. So with that said, we're asking you to support this particular amendment. We think it creates a good safe harbor for the industry. It makes sure that the agricultural folks' issues get addressed. It keeps the issues that come forward in the hands of professionals that can handle them the best, and we think it's fair to both sides of resolving this issue and basically getting decision makers in their appropriate silos, and not have local governments having to get into the issues that the state and federal agencies are getting into. I did want to say that we did keep in the local side of this. Because of LRAPA. You'll read in the bill that it also says local agencies. And we've included that because there's a unique situation in Lane County with LRAPA, so that's why that language is in there. So that's it. From our side, I would say that I had a lot of folks that are very interested and met with many of you on this. And when this issue came up today, they all said, well, we're going to be home with our wives enjoying the Valentine's Day. So that's where they're at, and I'm carrying the issue forward. I'm open for any questions. I'll stay if there's some, but I imagine there's going to be a few.
Representative Lively. So I have 232 questions. I'll start with number one. No, I don't have any. So I'm trying to understand. You used the term technical issues. So what I'm trying to understand in this, having pretty aware of local land use planning and the county's role and the city's role, so I'm trying to understand how this technical issue gets defined in a way that a city or a county isn't able to decide the issue versus the state or the federal government that in many cases is far removed from what the locals are dealing with. So that's the separation I don't understand.
The best way to do that, if I might, is to grab a couple of examples, and I think it's important to do that. So if you took groundwater, when we dig a mine site, especially in the valley, we have water, groundwater comes up, and we either dewater or we use it for washing. There is going to be impacts associated with that. But in order to assess those impacts, you have to put monitoring wells in, and you have to have a hydrologist to come in and evaluate that data and say, okay, here is the impacts, or here's what we can do to mitigate any of those impacts that happen. Dogami has specific authority for that and a hydrologist on board, and they have a statute that allows them to look at those issues. They're not the only one. On that particular issue, water resources also getting a water right, we have to go through the same thing with them and the same kind of analysis. Now, if a farmer comes in and raises an issue and says, hey, I got an agricultural conflict, I'm worried about this, right? Well, I mean, at that point, he's expressing it to the local government. He can express it to Dogami, and he can express it to Water Resources. But they routinely express it to the local governments, right? Mm-hmm. So what this does, it says, well, you know, that's kind of a technical issue that's really kind of in the bailiwick of a state agency. They're better situated for that. Let's let them decide. Now, if the groundwater issue is something that isn't covered by Dogami or isn't covered by Water Resources, the local government then has to deal with it regardless. That's how this language would work. The big issue, and I think you'll hear this often, and I want to address the dust issue, because there's no question that the dust has been driving this issue. Dust is even more direct, and DEQ regulates dust. We have to get air contaminant discharge permits, and many of you know we're going through all this air toxic stuff right now that applies to our industry, applies to the aggregate, applies to the concrete, applies to the asphalt folks. In DEQ's rules, we are not allowed, and it says no person can allow, can cause or allow an air contaminant discharge to cause a nuisance. So those things come into the nuisance law. Nuisance means substantial or unreasonable interference with the use or enjoyment of real property. But DEQ focuses on when that complaint would come in, would focus on the use. Are we affecting the use of that adjacent farmer, whether it's a high-value product that they're growing or a dust-sensitive product? DEQ is set up by rule to deal with that. And the next step is we have to abate it under their rule. And then after that, and what abatement means, by the way, is we have to eliminate the nuisance. There can't be any nuisance. That's the law. So the view that we don't address agricultural conflicts, you know, within the other state agencies is not exactly on point. We do have to do that. That particular one is interesting because DEQ has a whole laundry list of mitigation measures that we have to employ. Burns, we'll have to deal with vegetation to capture dust that may come off. We may have to water, and actually we do a lot of watering. And the new fight, because they just did the rules, is they wanted us actually to tarp all of our stockpiles or cover them. And we thought that's more dangerous for the worker and probably create more dust, because sprinkling is really the way to control dust on those things. So in that situation, applying this particular provision, if the Farmer Joe comes in and says, you know, here's my dust complaint. We're worried that we have a high-value product that's a dust-sensitive product. Local government has to look at it and say, is it related to what DEQ would normally do? If they do, they defer to it. They can't make findings. Basically, they won't be able to make findings that will substantially affect that particular practice or the cost of agriculture. And then the applicant has to get that permit, so they go through and address that issue with DEQ. I have others, but one of the biggest ones I should point out as we talk about this is last session, in 644, Senate Bill 644, you guys made the Department of Ag a commenting agency for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. That means the Department of Ag gets to comment on any of the application, you know, any of the issues around the application that DOGAMI may be issuing. That means farm conflicts and other kinds of things. So my point is there's lots of ways that conflicts get resolved at the state agency level, but the local government gets to make the decision if it's related to a conflict that an agency, a state, federal, local, environmental agency will address. And if it is, they get to defer that to them. They have to defer that to them by this law. Does that help?
It helped. Just follow. So I appreciate the examples. I just have to say, from a standpoint of a person that comes from local governments, the part that still local governments and the local citizens and businesses around there are the ones most closely impacted. And so I can appreciate deferring to state or federal these agencies. At the end of the day, that may not satisfy those local elected officials that are charged with protecting the public and doing those things. And so I'm just trying, from my standpoint, from a practical, I appreciate what you're trying to do. I am concerned about the cost of moving aggregate. All of those things concern me. But I'm also concerned about local jurisdictions and local elected officials and their abilities to respond to citizens, mm-hmm. be they in the cities or out of the cities, in that to what the citizens see are real concerns. And their answer not just being, well, we can do nothing about that because we have to defer to the state or the federal. That's not a very good answer to local people that don't think like the project.
If I might, Chairs and Representative Lively, remember this is narrowly tailored only to environmental considerations. So any health-related issues or transportation-related issues, those are all still within the purview, stay within the purview of local governments, and we didn't take that away. But the only thing we're asking is take away a very small area where there's an environmental consideration, and we just believe that given NOAA Fisheries and U.S. Fish and the Army Corps of Engineers and LRAPA and all the regulating state agencies, those environmental issues are better resolved by those people with that expertise than a local government official that's trying to back this, you know, herring from a and you know how this goes.
Oh, I know how it goes.
It's going to go like it is today. There's going to be one guy supporting the mining industry and lots of folks not supporting the mining
Thank
industry.
You. Representative Vial?
I just want to confirm, Rick, that ORS Chapter 197, the notice to everybody within 100 feet, the 14-day submission rules, none of that changes,
none
correct?
Of that changes.
So all the neighbors are still going to get the same chance to come weigh in. Okay.
And so the chairs and Representative Vial, that would be the case. And we don't want to change that. We want those comments coming in. But we just want to make we just believe that we can't have all this cross permitting going on, because it creates a lot of conflict within trying to get these things through. We have permits now that are out 10, 15 years, and I know you know that, and I know you know that, that we can't get them resolved because of how the not just the state, but in concert with the local and the federal agencies, can't seem to get through these processes. And it really comes down to, it's affecting your ability to get the biggest bang for your buck for the dollars that you're spending on these highway bills. And at some point, it's got to loosen up. And I know there's going to be folks here that think, you know, we don't want to have mining on farmland. But, you know, that's where the best rocks are, on the deepest deposits and the highest grade construction materials are. And we've got to find some balance in that. And this is just a little piece that we think will help the industry and allow things to start moving forward to be able to provide materials for all of you.
Representative McClain.
Well, I read the language and I've listened to you, and you've acknowledged that there's different responsibilities, and there's discrete different responsibilities at the federal, the state, and the local level. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, with the words that I see on the page, how you're managing with what you're suggesting as a new system is actually keeping those distinct responsibilities for, because they're not all the same. As you point out, not only are there, the state agencies don't all have the same responsibility, but all three of those levels have different permits for different purposes, and they have distinct, responsible, discrete responsibilities for a lot of things. And so I don't know if you can do it now or offline, but I absolutely do have a concern, because my chair said, if you have a concern, say it out loud.
Chair Beyer.
Would
you repeat that, please?
I said, my chair said that if I had a concern, say it out loud, so I'm sure to do that. But I do not see how you're preserving the discrete overview or review of different items. They're not all the same items. And I do agree that there's some issues as far as, you know, local land use law and different things like that. And I know you said it was only for environmental, but land use law and environmental, you know, they cross over. And so there's just some issues that I might be able to read it at 7 a.m. and it'll be a lot clearer. But
We're not meeting at 7 a.m.
I'm just not sure if you can, you know, try to do that in a few words. I would appreciate it.
I'll do it really succinct. Co-Chair Representative McClain, this doesn't affect at all any of the permitting functions of the agencies. They still go along and do their thing. This is just how local government will reflect back and look at what defer back to those state, local, federal agencies that are doing environmental issues.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, just colleagues, because it is the witching hour in 11 minutes, and there's a long list of people to my mind. I just want to point out for the record, so we know, that in House Bill 2017, in the original go-around, sections 14 and 20, that's where we all put into here and said we have a problem with access to aggregate because it's driving up the cost of roads. And it's ODOT has come back to us in our magic, you know, amendment sheet here and said, hey, please find a solution for this and give us direction. This is one of the options on the table to do that. So if we, I would encourage OCAPA to reach out to the members who have raised concerns, so on and so forth, because if this isn't the solution, then we still have the same problem in the same original bill. So this is the solution that's here. And again, it's getting the witching hour, but I just want to point out, even ODOT has said we need a better solution. And that's the cost solution that we've put in the original bill in sections 14 and 80 to impact Connect Oregon and the transportation stuff. So just keep in mind, whatever solution we come up with, we need to come up with one. And if not, then we're going to be here in February coming up with a new solution. So there we go. Thank you.
All righty. Anybody else? Thank you, Rich. Okay. Marianne and Bruce Chapin and Peter Kanagi.
Kanagi.
Co-Chair Chairs Beyer and McEwen and members of the committee, for the record, I am Marianne Cooper here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I will try to keep my comments as brief as I can given the complexity of the subject matter, but I guess what I will say is this is a very complex land use bill that is we have a lot of concerns about and would at the very least urge the committee to slow down and look at this in the interim. And we have been and remain willing to work on solutions to this issue. We do agree that complex permitting processes benefit no one and can get really burdensome for folks going through them and trying to get layers of permitting done. That said, we cannot support a process that excludes folks in the public and neighboring landowners that have legitimate concerns from getting those addressed. And the biggest concern that I have about this bill is if you look at the language, so aggregate projects go through a conditional use process, and to get permitted in a farm zone, you have to show that you're not going to significantly increase the cost of farming practices on surrounding lands or force a significant change in those practices. And that's the land use standard. It's the existing land use standard. And this bill basically says you can't find significant impacts for air, water, or noise if those are addressed by other, basically, if there's other statutes that govern those. And there will be, but for example, you don't always trigger a water quality permit from DEQ, nor does that permit always look at impacts to neighboring wells, if you're going to collapse those wells, if you're going to impact people's ability to water animals, to provide domestic water for their workers. That's not included in DEQ's permit always. Occasionally it does get there if those concerns are brought forward, but if you're getting like a stormwater permit, that impacts the groundwater are not going to be looked at. That's a surface water permit. The way I read this bill, if there is any sort of law that governs, so if you don't trigger a water quality permit, but there's one that you could trigger, you cannot address those issues at the local level. And so that means that folks could be having impacts to their wells that go unaddressed. They could be unable to provide water to workers, water to livestock, and those aren't addressed. And the responsibility of addressing those issues would fall solely on them for a new use moving in next door to them. And so we have said on the record since 2015, we are willing to come to the table. We are willing to have the conversation around streamlining and trying to make sure that the permitting processes are clear and that the standards are clear. But you can't bring a standard from DEQ and come in and say it's protective of neighbors, because it was designed to be protective of public health. It was designed to either look at surface water impacts under the Clean Water Act or groundwater impacts if it's a WPCF permit. But those are not triggered by every application. I actually pulled up here the DEQ process, and they basically say, you know, are you having surface water runoff? If no, you don't trigger a surface water permit. Are you using water to wash? If no, you don't trigger a WPCF permit. But those permits do exist in the way I read this bill. Because they exist, you could never address water quality at the local level. And so for us, it's you can't interchange those standards and say that it's protective of neighbors. And it's just a very complicated land use issue that we are more than willing to work on and more than willing. We've offered solutions in the past around streamlining and around addressing, making sure that you're not having, you know, two agencies looking at a single issue or two agencies issuing any kind of conflicting directives. But we have not reached a conclusion in those conversations. We have offered things in the past that I think haven't been satisfactory. We're willing to continue those conversations, but would really urge you not to put a complex land use fix with pretty far-reaching consequences across Oregon into a bill without additional conversation and without additional work in the interim with impacted stakeholders.
Co-chairs McEwen and Beyer.
McEwen. Thank you. Happens all the time. You get a pass.
For the record, my name is Peter Kanagi. I'm a resident of Benton County. I'm a farmer, a longtime farmer. And I also spent about 13 years on the Benton County Planning Commission, during which time we did go through the approval of a Knife River plant in what is now Linn County, but at the time was Benton County. And this makes me, the Dash 7 amendments make me really nervous about what options it's going to leave for neighbors, particularly farmers of aggregate plants. One of the things I think it's important to keep in mind is when you look at the makeup of the aggregate industry within the state, now, it's a huge percent of it is owned by three multinational companies. And what those companies are asking you to do is take away the right of the neighbors who know the land, who know the area, to have say in what those impacts will be for the neighbors who are there, vested there for years and years and years in our family farms. And those kind of impacts can be really, really significant.
Thank you. I'm Bruce Chapin, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm an orchard at farm just north of Salem here. Been involved with the agri-industry all of my adult life. Going back to 1973, my father was selling gravel when they widened the freeway between Woodburn and Salem. All that gravel came off our farm. He did it in a manner that we did not lose any farmland. In fact, actually, we gained some farmland out of the deal. And that became a model that was strongly influenced the 1996 agreement, where two industries got together and agreed that they could mine in the Willamette Valley as long as they went deep, and so as to minimize the amount of farmland, or good farmland, that was being lost. And that was then incorporated in 1996 into the rewrite of the Goal 5 process. In 2004 through 2007, I sat on the governor's consensus process. On that group there, we tried to come to some agreement on how to resolve some issues. It was a very good education for everybody. And currently, I serve as chairman of the Oregon Farm Bureau Aggregate Committee. And I'd like to say I do love rocks, okay? We need rocks. The question is, where should we get them from? We, as an industry, we want to keep working with the aggregate industry and figure out ways we can coexist. It's very important to do that because, like I said, we do need rocks, but you also need farmland too. The problem has not been in the land use laws. 97% of the permits they apply for between 1997 and currently have been permitted. So the land use process is not the stumbling block. They're having problems, and they have some legitimate problems as in the other levels of regulation. And that's where I think the focus needs to be. For example, between here and Amity, or excuse me, here and Dayton, I know of three large sites that have been permitted that are not being mined yet, or haven't started mining yet. One of them is still fighting, not with the land use system, but through the other permits still. And this has been going on for years. So we do not really have an immediate shortage of rock available out here, at least not in this area, what I'm seeing. And these sites, I'm talking 300 acres in one, 200 in another, and I think about 400 in the third. now I got all off my notes. I have no idea where I'm at. Okay. The state and federal permitting systems, those other agencies, they're not dealing with the issues that we're dealing with at the local levels, which is how will it affect the surrounding farm uses. And that's what's important to us. And we need to really look at that. And let me give you some examples where I feel this would fail. Water usage. We have a water rights system in the state. Very good program, I would say. However, the aggregate industry, they can dewater their pits, and they don't need a water right. So that system isn't going to protect it, is it? We need to be able to come back and look at the local level in the permitting process and evaluate that. Water quality. Agriculture, we're under lots of regulations to make sure that we don't contaminate our groundwater. We have to seal our wells off, our irrigation wells are sealed off. Not only do we seal the top of the well, we have to, when they drill a well, we have to put a expanding clay around the outside of the well so it makes it truly a watertight seal. In contrast, the aggregate industry goes over and digs a deep lake into a gravel, into the same aquifer, in which you have thousands of geese nightly landing in it, depositing large amounts of organic matter, raw sewage, and it's without regard for what that's doing for the aquifer. That's occurring within 900 feet of my well that we drink out of. So far, there's not been any problems. And I hope that continues to be the case, but it is a concern. We got a disconnect here. Rich mentioned dust. The dust issue that keeps coming up, the example that keeps coming up is had to do with Eugene Sand and Gravel several years ago, in which you had a mining site that was coming up and close proximity to two fruit stands. It was showed in the hearings, it was well established that there was going to be significant problems to the farming operations there as a result of it. That fight actually degenerated down to where, in the final end, it got to court, and the issue they were arguing over, I'm not making this up, it was whether a farmer selling his produce was considered a farm practice. If we can't sell the produce, we're not going to be doing the other things to raise it. We're not going to be plowing. We're not going to be cultivating. We're not going to be planting. We're not going to be fertilizing. And we're not going to be selling it, okay, or harvesting it. So that, just kind of understand, there's two sides to this issue a little bit on that. Sadly, they as you can see tonight, the agri industry is still a little upset over that. And I think perhaps that's not appropriate at this point. It was a fair hearing, fair settlement. I think the conclusion was correct on that. What this, and I think several of you have hit on it tonight, one of the big issues here, what this is going to do is create another layer of things to argue about. Is this an issue that we can talk about in the local land use or not? How far did the, what, where the division is going to be between what we can do, I'm wording that wrong, but it, I've just had a few hours to read this, as all of you had too, this amendment, but it's very ambiguous, in my opinion, is what we can do. Any questions? We'll be happy to answer questions.
Any questions at this panel?
I just have one really quick. Bruce, what are the three sites? Are they all off of Wallace Road that you mentioned going toward Dayton?
Two of them are in Grand Island.
Okay.
One of them was the Baker Rock site that Rich mentioned. And they're still trying to get, as my understanding, still having some problems with some floodplain permits. That's not a land use issue. Okay.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay.
Anybody else? Thank you very much. And our last panel, let's see, Ellen Miller, Lisa Hansen, and Shannon Hearn. Welcome.
Am I going first? Good evening, Co-Chair Beyer, Co-Chair McEwen, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I came tonight to listen to the Dash 7 amendments and kind of learn what the problem was that was being attempted to be fixed, as also what it means, the language in there, as far as land use planning and the permitting systems. From a Fish and Wildlife perspective, we partner with the other agencies because we don't have authorities as land managers in the state. We piggyback onto their permit systems, and then we work with the counties because the land use planning system is our way to protect fish and wildlife habitat and get them considered as these projects develop. So aggregate mining falling under goal 5, that's our natural resource focused area for protecting seasonal habitats, sensitive species, riparian areas, those things. After listening to the testimony, I can say I'm clearer on the problem. Thank you for that, Senator Boquist. I also do hear what folks are trying to do. I can't say at this point that I feel, as the legislative coordinator, I really have enough information to analyze how this would affect the department and Fish and Wildlife. I can tell you tonight and tomorrow we will be spending time analyzing this, and we will get you something here in writing very soon. I'm happy to answer any questions that I might answer, but that's where we are right now.
Thank you. Ellen?
Good evening, Chair Beyer, Co-Chair McEwen, and members of the committee. For the record, Ellen Miller with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm going to echo Shannon's comments. I also attended this evening to learn more about this Dash 7 amendment. After hearing the presentations before us, I am a little concerned about how the amendment will actually work, how the law would actually work. With the different jurisdictions. So I just want to register that we will likely be coming back to you, as Shannon said, with some written testimony about any concerns that our department might have. A point that I do want to make is that there is an existing process for counties to identify and to permit, to allow the mining of these aggregate sites. And this process was established using a very broad stakeholder group, and it took a very long time. And so we would ask that you consider, you know, a broader conversation among stakeholders in the interim, and we remain open to talking about streamlining permitting processes and addressing the concerns of the committee. So thank you.
Thank you. Lisa.
Good evening. Alisa Nelson, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And we come to you with a unique position in that our agency has to promote agriculture as well as protect the natural resource. We appreciate that transportation is vital for us to getting our products to market. That said, as we've visited with many of you over the last couple of years, we've talked a lot about coexistence and the challenges that coexistence brings to agriculture. It appears in the Dash 7 amendments that this would change the process for mitigating for agriculture from those mining activities. And we have concerns that with that, the amendment may not continue to promote coexistence between the two natural resource uses. And we wanted to, like my colleagues, bring that forward, and when our land use specialists and others are back in the office tomorrow, have a chance to evaluate more and potentially provide some written comment.
Questions to this panel? Don't see any. I think you've worn us out. Thank you very much. That's all we had. Is there anybody else who needs to or wishes to testify? If not, I think we've hit the end of our meeting, and we are adjourned.